This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. Well, today we're talking about the power crisis in Texas, why it happened, and what it says about the state of energy grids in Indiana and across the country. If you have questions or comments on our show today, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. You call us at 866-476-3881. You just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. You can also send us high-quality voice messages with our smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. It's free and easy to use. You just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Today, we're joined by a panel of experts. I'd like to welcome Doug Gotham, the director of the State Utility Forecasting Group at Purdue University. Also, Peter Sinclair is an independent videographer who specializes in energy and climate, also produces a monthly piece for Yale Climate Connections. And Danielle McGrath, president of the Indiana Energy Association. Again, welcome, everyone. Now, the Texas energy crisis, it was massive. And Peter, I'd like to kind of start with you to talk about what people in Texas are saying about what happened there a few weeks ago.
Well, I've spoken to a lot of experts and journalists in Texas, and 3 points kind of jump out at me. I think the Texas blackouts are a watershed event that showed definitely that this notion we've had for many years of so-called baseload energy kind of needs review. That is, the idea has always been if you have enough coal, gas, and nuclear generation online, you'll always have reliable power. But all of those sources, especially gas turbines, failed massively in Texas. Second, climate disruption is here, no matter what you think is causing it. One expert told me, we have built our grid for Ozzie and Harriet weather, but we're already facing Mad Max, and it's getting worse. And third, energy technology is changing at blazing speed. The price of solar, wind, and battery storage for energy have dropped so much in recent years that they're now at prices that experts just 5 or 10 years ago thought we would not see until maybe 2050. So all these factors were already massively changing our grid infrastructure, and the Texas events are probably going to be an accelerant or a turbocharge to those changes.
Yeah. Do you get a sense that maybe this could have been prevented, though, if certain things had been done?
Well, absolutely. This is not a unique event. This has happened before. And 1989 and 2011. And for instance, in 1989, long before there was ever any renewable energy or anything, anybody had ever heard of that on the Texas grid, they had a similar weather event. And there was a review done by the federal government. They determined that the grid design was adequate. Power plants were tripping offline. There were cutoffs in gas service, lines freezing up, rolling blackouts. And the whole Texas grid almost collapsed, just like it did 2 weeks ago. The same thing happened in 2011. And again, a review was done. Findings were made. Recommendations were made. They were not followed. And so, Texas found itself this time with an event that was not entirely unique, but probably more intense than what they've seen in a long time, certainly living memory. And it may turn out to be the most costly weather disaster in American history when we finally tally it up.
Yeah. What is going on right now today?
Well, there's a whole lot of people that are still worrying about water. Most of the power is back on, but that one of the lessons was that these systems, water, gas, and electricity in particular, are all kind of dependent on each other. And when one started to falter, they all began to kind of fail in sort of a cascade. And so across Texas and into Louisiana, there are still communities that have very low water pressure. They're depending on bottled water. There's incredible water damage from frozen pipes across Texas. And so a whole lot of cleanup and a lot of the damage is have not been tallied up. But I think the lessons are going to become clear in coming months, although whether Texas decides to act on them this time, I don't know. Anybody's guess.
Yeah. Do residents there have the option to select their own energy provider?
That's a great question. I'm wondering if you know that one, Doug. I think that there's a thing called Gridley in Texas, which is one of the selection of energy providers that you can sign up with. And this is what got an awful lot of people in trouble, is that they have a menu of contracts that they can go with. You can go with all solar power, all wind power. You can go with the low cost contract. You can go with a higher cost contract that has more guarantees. And a lot of people signed up for the low cost contract without reading the fine print and realizing that in times of shortage, their bill could go up by hundreds of times. And so that's where you may have seen the stories about the single mom in Fort Worth who suddenly has a $10,000 power bill, mm-hmm. or the city of Denton, Texas, which has a $200 million power bill for 1 week, which is more than they spent all last year. So the governor of Texas has, and the legislature in particular, have their hands full trying to figure out, do they try to enforce all of these insane power bills on people who clearly can't afford them, or do they have to change their system? Does the state step in and bail people out? A whole lot of things that probably should have been foreseen that were not, and now it's kind of up in the air.
I guess the outages raised a question that many are wondering. Is anything that happened there, could that happen here in Indiana? And Doug, do you see anything there that relates in some way to our energy situation here in Indiana?
Well, I would never say never, because there's always some possibility of a kind of a perfect storm of events. But I would say that it's extremely unlikely that what happened in Texas would happen here, at least for the same reasons.
Can you explain a bit about how it's different from Texas, our power system?
Sure. There's two major things. One, we build our generators to withstand Indiana weather, winters. Texas doesn't build their generators to withstand Indiana winters. And that's basically what they kind of got, was the kind of stuff we might see during the winter, in the wintertime. They had cooling pipes freezing up. They had some of their wind turbines weren't designed to operate in the winter, and they froze up. And the natural gas system basically completely froze up. Here in Indiana, we build to expect that. So that's one of the issues, is we're prepared for that. I'm not saying that extreme weather couldn't take down some of our generation, but it's unlikely that the kind of winter weather that they saw in Texas would have a significant impact in Indiana. The other issue is the fact that we are interconnected with our neighbors, and Texas is not. So if we do have generators go out, then we can try to import power from Ohio or Kentucky or Michigan, and actually all the way from the East Coast to the Rocky Mountains is interconnected. And so there are ways of getting power from others who maybe have a surplus at the time. And Texas being separated from the rest of the network doesn't have that opportunity.
All right. Danielle, you are the president of the Indiana Energy Association. Can you give us a little background on what you do at the Indiana Energy Association?
Absolutely. The IEA is made up of 14 investor-owned natural gas and electric companies, as well as a public charitable trust. And so when it comes to working with the members, public policy, speaking on behalf of them at, you know, in forums like this. That's really the role and the function of the IEA. But our members are companies, of course, that will sound familiar to many on the phone today. And so certainly not all inclusive, but some of them include AES Indiana, Duke Energy, Indiana Michigan Power, CenterPoint Energy, as well as Citizens Gas.
And how do they all work together and stay accountable?
Absolutely. So when it comes to Indiana, we are regulated entities, unlike some of the other states. On top of that, our companies on the electric side are also part of two regional transmission organizations, which has been discussed. And so they're members of both MISO as well as PJM. And when it comes to accountability, ultimately, at the end of the day, the electric companies are the ones who are responsible for ensuring that they have resource adequacy and reliability and that they're able to meet the needs of their customers. But we also work very closely with a number of other stakeholders, from state agencies to local governments, federal agencies, the regional transmission organizations, and many others to make sure that there is coordination and understanding in terms of how we're going to meet customer needs, not just within the state of Indiana, but the region as a whole.
All right. So again, it's not just local, regional, but it's statewide as well, correct? I mean, it's everybody as a whole.
That's correct. And, you know, the RTOs manage and operate the wholesale markets. And so in terms of the generation, that is how that is bought and exchanged and managed, you know, in that role and in that capacity.
All right. Well, I'd like to talk to you a little bit more when we come back after our break about how Indiana compares to other states. And when you look at this energy crisis like the one that happened in Texas, kind of looking at the state as a whole, are we prepared if something like that happened? But we'll be right back with our guest after just a quick break. We're talking about climate change and energy grids in the light of the recent disaster in Texas. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866. That's 476-3881. Again, 866-476-3881. I'm Taylor Bennett. We'll be right back after a short break. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. Well, today we're talking about the recent power crisis in Texas and what it says about energy grids and utilities in Indiana and across the country. We'd love your questions and comments on this topic today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. And you can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. You just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we will try to get it onto the show today. Danielle, when you look at Indiana and we compare to other states and you look at this energy crisis like the one that happened in Texas, do you think we're more or less prepared?
So the companies spend a ton of time planning, preparing, thinking through the different scenarios. And so it's hard to say that there's going to be a comparison of who's better, who's not as good, you know, at doing this. It's the fact that utilities have a responsibility to make sure that they are planning. And I can tell you that our Indiana companies have done just that. When you look at the outages across the United States, Indiana did not experience those. And while we're not immune to outages, there are many things that we do to make sure that they don't happen. And so, for example, all of the companies have emergency preparedness plans. Diversification is a big point to make in all of this. Infrastructure investments. We communicate regularly with our customers to prevent, you know, situations where there's, you know, uncertainty. And then ultimately mutual assistance if and when it's so catastrophic that we need to bring in additional expertise and assistance to help get the power back on as quickly as possible. So those are just a few of the actions that we take to be proactive on that front.
Do you think that since Indiana is connected to other states as far as its power grid is concerned, that it has the ability to pull power in from neighbors in case that we do lose power here?
Absolutely. And we actually saw that during this last polar vortex. And so MISO and PJM work together. They're interconnected. And so it's not just about MISO's region and PJM's. It's really about how the regions work in unison. And so there were instances where PJM was exporting power to MISO. In other instances, it may work differently from that. But it's that level of collaboration and interconnectedness that really makes a difference at the end of the day.
Peter, you're north of us. You're in Michigan. What do you see when you look at the situation in Texas and then you relate it to states like Michigan and Indiana? Do you think there's something similar or different about these states?
Well, what people are telling me is that nobody should be too complacent about their local grid. The tough thing is, like when you're driving in traffic, you have to be aware of what your blind spots are. And the nature of blind spots is that often we don't see them. But certainly, people, experts in general who have been looking at our grid for decades have been saying that better transmission is a no-brainer. Our transmission was built 60 to 70 years ago, and it was built to last 50 years. So do the math. We're due for an upgrade. And a good upgrade would be one that would make it a truly national grid. We have a lot of areas where we can't, for instance, get as much wind energy out of the Great Plains as we'd like to, because we don't have good transmission there. We would ideally be able to share wind and solar energy from one end of the continent to the other, based on where there was the best supply and where there was the most demand. As your other guest mentioned, Texas has this problem that they've isolated their grid. Texans are independent bunch, and they don't like to they didn't want to have to deal with federal energy regulations, so they opted out of being able to trade energy with other states. But ironically, that could mean that following this, they're going to see some fairly draconian regulations and requirements imposed by their own state government. And Governor Abbott has already talked about that.
Right.
One other thing is that what I'm going to watch and see is what this does for the market for energy storage devices. Because they are out there. Tesla has what they call a power wall. There's several other competitors. And there's a number of accounts online on YouTube of people who had these devices and were very glad that they had them weathering this event.
How do those work?
Well, basically, you can put it on the wall or, outside your house or in your garage. And say a Tesla Powerwall will store about 13 kilowatt hours of power, meaning you can run your house for about a half a day on that. And if you turn things down a little bit, you can go longer. If you've got solar panels on your roof and you can keep charging them, I watched one guy's account of even with the snow and the inclement weather and the clouds, he was able with his power wall and his solar cells to keep his refrigerator operating, so he didn't lose any food. He kept a minimal amount of heat in the house, so he was relatively comfortable, and he was able to use his devices and his lights at least most of the time or intermittently while his neighbors were pretty much out. Mm-hmm. Keep an eye out, because we're looking 10 years in the future. A lot of people are going to have electric cars in their garage, and those batteries will hold something like 80 kilowatt hours of storage, and there will be some companies that will probably offer the option of being able to plug that into your house and meet your own demand in an emergent situation such as this. So I really look for this Texas event to kind of change the equation, because I suspect a lot of those independent Texans are going to be looking at some of these systems pretty closely.
How likely is some of those systems could be implemented in, say, Midwest states?
Well, of course, I think there are different regulations in different states, and there are, as always, engineering challenges and things to overcome. But the technology is coming on really fast, and a lot of people are already adopting these things. So I think, your mileage might vary region to region, but you're going to see a lot more of these in the very near future.
Oh, that's interesting. Doug, can you talk about what your group does, the State Utility Forecasting Group?
Sure. We are located at Purdue University, employees of the university, and we provide economic and policy analysis to the state of Indiana, the regulators and the legislature, as well as some work for groups that aren't strictly in Indiana. We focus on the long-term planning, forecasting of electricity usage. We look at where electricity prices are expected to go and what new resources the state might need.
So when it comes to energy, then, in the state, is that the kind of data that you find more useful to you when you look at those things?
Yes, definitely. Always looking at anything that might affect the electricity industry, because then that's going to affect our modeling, our projections, and so forth.
And when you look at that information and that data that you put together, is there anything about Indiana's energy grid that isn't being tracked right now that you're aware of or you looked at as much as it should be?
Well, I think it's what Peter referred to as your blind spot. And that's the difficult part, is you don't know what's in your blind spot. I think there are potential factors that could be significant in the future. One of them would be, for instance, the potential for significant drought. If we had an extreme prolonged drought, it's going to affect river levels, lake levels, and some of our generators use that for cooling. If you take that opportunity away, you take the generator away. So there are some issues that, and I know Danielle and the utilities kind of look at some of this stuff, but I think there are some areas out there that we do need to be aware of.
How long have you been tracking data?
Oh, we've been doing this since 1985.
Are you seeing any trends?
We're not seeing the growth in electricity usage that we used to see. Before we were formed, we saw very rapid growth in electricity use. Back in the 90s, the early 2000s, we're probably seeing growth on the range of about 2% a year. Over the last 10 years, it's been fairly flat. So we're not seeing growth there. The other thing we're seeing is the utilities are moving toward diversifying their generation mix. So we used to be extremely heavily reliant on coal. We still use a fair amount of coal generation in the state, but we're seeing a lot of movement toward other resources like wind and solar.
Danielle, another focus for your group is infrastructure investment. How would you rate the current state of that here in the state?
We have been given the tools to make sure that we are able to invest in our generation, transmission, and distribution systems, which is critical. And so a couple of the factors that are really driving the investment right now are upgrades and replacement of aging infrastructure, the expansion of the transmission system to integrate renewables and other forms of generation, the hardening or winterization of assets. And so that, means insulation and protection of critical equipment, heating, to make sure that, the infrastructure isn't freezing up like we've seen elsewhere. And so that's something that we already do and will, of course, continue to do. Improvements to comply with transmission reliability and compliance standards. And then I would just add, the addition of infrastructure to meet anticipated load growth. But as, Doug had mentioned, that has somewhat plateaued.
What kind of investment are we talking about, as far as money is concerned, to make some of those things happen?
Yeah. So in any given year for a single company, you're talking about millions of dollars. And when you start to look at the broader industry, it quickly adds up. And so, you know, you're talking about billions. Over the next, you know, about 7 years, we're looking at least $4+ billion just for the investor-owned companies. That's not accounting for the rural electric membership cooperatives or the municipal utilities we also offer.
I'm sorry, you broke up there. What was the last part?
Oh, the amount of money that I had just mentioned, mm-hmm. I was saying that that's strictly for the investor-owned companies. That doesn't include the rural electric membership cooperatives or the municipal utilities, which also serve the state of Indiana.
All right. You also talk about diversification. Exactly does that mean?
Yeah. So, you know, Indiana has a longstanding tradition of an all of the above approach to energy. And so that includes wind, solar, natural gas, coal, and even nuclear. A lot of folks don't know that Indiana is served by a nuclear facility in Michigan that's owned by AEP. And so Indiana Michigan Power is the company that owns and operates that. And so, you know, when we look at resiliency overall, it comes down to if there's an issue with one resource, we're able to lean on the others more heavily. When we're talking about cost effectiveness, you know, we can, you know, have some of our portfolio that help offset others. There's a whole host of pros and cons associated with each type. But, you know, when used together, they're complementary. And so, you know, we've all heard, you know, when the wind isn't shining when the sun isn't shining or when the wind isn't blowing, you need to have backup. And I think that's really where baseload comes in. It's not an either or, it's an and. And we need to figure out where are those, you know, shortfalls and, you know, how do we have them work together to really make sure that we have a reliable and resilient grid at the end of the day.
What do you think are some of the shortfalls that we have?
You know, right now in Indiana, we are positioned well. I think that, you know, as we're talking about the broader transition that's underway to more renewables, it really comes down to how do we manage this? How do we look at innovation and incorporate that while also ensuring that, you know, it's not too much too soon? So it comes down to striking the right balance. And I think that those conversations are happening where they should with the utility companies, with regulators, with policymakers, and of course, you know, at the federal government level as well.
Is there anything going on at the State House right now as far as energy is concerned that we should be tracking?
Absolutely. There's a number of bills on the energy front that are actively being heard or explored. One of them having to do with the whole issue of resource adequacy and reliability is House Bill 1520. That is authored by Representative Ed Soliday. This bill looks to make sure that it's connected with all of the stakeholders. And so how are the utilities ensuring that they have enough capacity to meet the needs of their customers? And it's requiring the companies to file a report with the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission, which is the regulator, on what is the capacity that they're relying on, how much is needed, where is it located, questions and answers along those lines to make sure that the state is aware of Indiana's energy position. And, you know, to the extent that, you know, they need to ask questions or intervene, they're able to do so. And that's something that, you know, like I said, resource adequacy and reliability are ultimately going to be on the utility company. But certainly we understand there are a number of other stakeholders out there who need to have this information as well. The State Utility Forecasting Group, of course, is very familiar with all of this. They gather many of the same data points for incorporation in their report. So none of this is meant to supplant the other. It's really meant to be complementary.
What kind of support does it have over there at the State House?
That one, broad support, bipartisan. I think everyone understands that energy issues are of critical importance, and this is something that we need to be mindful of going forward.
Have we had luck in the past with legislation?
On this front, or... So this is the first bill of its kind that's come through. And I guess maybe I should pivot a little bit. To talk more broadly about energy policy, there is a 21st Century Energy Policy Development Task Force that was created several years ago. And this was made up of subject matter experts, as well as legislators, who came together in a bipartisan fashion, nonpartisan actually, to talk about the challenges facing the state of Indiana and what the opportunities are. And so they issued a report last year that outlined a number of different priorities and issues. This resource adequacy and reliability bill was one of them that they talked about was needed and necessary. There is another bill this year that is going to extend the life of the task force for another 2 years so that they can come back and talk about other pressing issues facing the state and or opportunities, you know, whether it be electric vehicle, things of that nature.
Okay. All right. Well, sounds like a lot is going on, like you said, very broad, but some things definitely to keep an eye on. All right. Well, we will be right back after a quick break. We're talking with experts about energy grids and the impact climate change is having. I'm Taylor Bennett. We'll be right back. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. Now back now to our discussion on energy grids and utilities and what we can learn from the energy crisis in Texas. As always, we love to hear your questions and comments. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from. That number is 866-476-3881. Peter, let's go back to the Texas story for just a little bit. What did you make of the way that those events were portrayed by state officials and the politicians there?
Well, it's pretty fascinating. I've been following Texas journalism actually for quite a while. It's some of the best energy journalism on the planet, you can imagine. And the Texas journalists were on this pretty closely, and they were aware that this blackout was not caused by a few wind turbines freezing up. And so fascinating to hear Governor Abbott, Texas Governor Abbott, in his press conference, pretty much playing it straight for the Texas journalists in terms he said the gas went down, it froze up at the wellhead, it froze up in the lines. The cooling water was freezing up. They had a nuclear plant, one nuclear plant go down. Another nuclear plant came very close to going down. And something like a third of their coal plants went down for a variety of reasons. But practically on the same day, Governor Abbott was on Fox News and telling kind of a different story, that it was all the fault of the Green New Deal and all these newfangled solar and wind turbines and everything. And you have to wonder whether the $26 million in fossil fuel money that the governor has received over the last few years might have something to do with the story he tells on Fox, where he thinks he's not going to get a whole lot of pushback. Mm-hmm. So it's been interesting to watch, but I think the larger story is getting pretty much accurate coverage now nationwide.
I mean, do you think though there's a lot of blame going on, that blame game?
Well, of course, because the lawsuits are starting, mm-hmm. and I mentioned this. Power provider Gridley earlier, they are now the target of a $1 billion class action lawsuit. And I'm sure by now there's probably a half a dozen more of those in the queue. And the Texas legislature is in session to kind of grill utility executives and they're asking, whose fault is this? Who can we assign the blame to? But in fact, it's really the Texas legislature that creates the rules that all these power operators operate by. And so it's going to take for them to come to a solution is going to take kind of a hard look in the mirror, I think, and figure out what it is they have to change. And maybe if there's some things that Texans have traditionally, the way Texans have traditionally done things might no longer be adequate or might not be, or might be in need of modification.
Do you think though that the residents understand really what is going on Is there a lot of public understanding?
Well, that, you know, I'm not on the ground there, but mm-hmm. just from what I've seen in media, it seems that there's a lot of awareness that a lot of responsibility lies with the leadership. And Texas leadership has been pretty much one party for the last 25 or 30 years. I don't think it's a newsflash for anybody that the fossil fuel industry has a pretty big say in the way things are running in Texas. They've done a lot of things very well. They've brought a lot of innovation to energy markets. They've pushed a lot of technology. But I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in, say, the next election. And that'll probably give us the best gauge of just how the people of Texas are kind of assigning responsibility here.
What is the media coverage right now? What are they focusing on?
Well, there have been hearings in the legislature. That's kind of ongoing. And then there's a tremendous amount of coverage of people picking up and trying to find a plumber, for instance. If there's any plumbers in the audience and you've got some spare time and some extra equipment, you might consider going down to Texas for a few weeks because you can probably charge whatever you want down there. And adding up the damages. I've heard damage estimates anywhere from tens of billions to hundreds of billions in damages. And if it's hundreds of billions, then it's going to be more costly than Hurricane Katrina, which up till mm-hmm. now is the most costly weather disaster we've had.
Yeah, that's amazing. I guess when you look to as far as the understanding of what's going on and if just the general public understands, sometimes, you know, it's a lot of things in the media that you get some misinformation. And Doug, I want to ask you, when you look at making predictions, especially when you're looking at long-term predictions, what's the most challenging thing about that when you try to make predictions and try to get accurate information out there?
So I would say two things for us is the biggest driver for electricity usage is the economy. And trying to do a 20-year forecast where you're not going to know when the next great recession is going to hit, that kind of thing. So economic projections are always a challenge, trying to get something that is hopefully accurately reflective of the future. The other thing would be essentially regulatory policy. So trying to guess what that's going to be 10, 15, 20 years down the line, whether that's on the environmental side or other policy that will affect things.
Is there anything coming up that you're excited to get involved with to further understand, especially when it relates to what's going on here in Indiana?
Well, I don't necessarily know of anything specific to Indiana. I think the biggest unknown for us right now in terms of policy would be some type of cap or tax on carbon.
On carbon?
Yes.
Is that something?
So, and I don't see that coming from the state, but there's that for several years, there's been some talk at the federal level of trying to impose a carbon tax. We kind of wait and see, but that would be a game changer.
And what does that look like, that tax, carbon tax?
Well, there's different forms that it would take, but essentially, it would be a tax on carbon dioxide emissions, or essentially so the utility, when they're generating electricity, if they're using coal or natural gas producing carbon dioxide, they would pay a tax to the government in order to emit that, which would then reflect on your electricity bill. One of the ways that's been talked about doing that is trying to do it in a from the government perspective in a revenue neutral basis, where the government would then offset other taxes like income tax. They would lower the income tax, or they would make direct payments to citizens in order to cover that. What it would do, it would essentially provide a disincentive to doing things that emit natural gas or carbon dioxide.
And what kind of environmental impact would that have?
I'm not the climate scientist to tell you how much we need to do. But one of the things from talking to the climate scientists, one of the things, if we're going to fight climate change, we need to reduce emissions of carbon dioxide.
Danielle, when you look at what Indiana needs to do, and we're looking at the overall big picture, is there anything specific that you think the state needs to do that we're not doing right now?
I think Indiana has a lot of potential on the energy front. We're looking to, continue to diversify. It's going to be different for each company in terms of what that appropriate balance is. We certainly have all sorts of different opportunities for innovation coming down the pike. Peter mentioned a little bit about, battery storage. That's something that is certainly of interest to many. We know that things are also happening, to that point on the electric vehicle front. And so how do all of these changes, whether it be on the innovation side, regulation side, how do they come together and impact us is really the big question. And I think having the right people around the table to talk about it, to bring these ideas forward is really going to be what's critical for Indiana as we, remain on the map and continue to do well in the space.
You were talking earlier a little bit about some things over at the State House and just making sure that people are all on board with the same things. Is it difficult to have conversations around energy? It can seem so complicated when you look at the different sources of energy.
It is. It's definitely easy find yourself having, questions or not understanding, the ins and outs of it. But at the end of the day, there are a number of different folks out there who are committed to helping, everyone understand this. So whether you're a customer and you have questions, reach out to your utility company for, an explanation. If there's, something on your bill, certainly legislators will reach out to, subject matter experts like the State Utility Forecasting Group for information and an understanding of what's happening. The Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission is another excellent resource. And so, yes, while it's, sometimes arcane and difficult, once you break it down, it's something that's important for us all to understand. And so there's certainly a way to do that. And there's a lot of resources out there to help people along.
Well, what's your advice and to say to someone if they want to talk to their lawmaker, they want to talk to legislators, maybe they're opposed to something to change their mind or, looking at these issues? How do you address that?
Well, the General Assembly has a ton of information on their website. So who is your senator or who is your representative? And so if you don't know, you can go online and find out that information. And each one of those individuals then has a page dedicated to the legislation that they're working on and a way to contact them. So there's certainly a lot of transparency as it relates to that. And the website is easy to use and very accessible for folks wanting to know more about what's going on at the State House.
All right. And Peter, you produce a monthly piece for Yale Climate Connections. Can you explain a little bit about that and exactly what that is about?
Well, Yale Climate Connections is a blog out of the Yale School of Environment, and I've been producing a monthly video for them for about 10 years. They also have some of the finest writers, many of whom are scientists themselves, covering all manner and all cross-section of this issue, which includes, the details of climate science, what the science is telling us, and what the solutions might be. And it's highly recommended, Yale Climate Connections, as a good, reliable resource for this kind of information.
What are you working on, anything in particular coming up?
Well, Yeah, I just finished a sort of a video explainer of what happened in Texas. And if you go to climateconnections.org, I'm sure you can find it there. And then I'm always talking to scientists with the idea of further projects. I'm going to be talking to more people in Texas. I continue to follow that issue because I think it's going to have a very long tail in terms of its influence. But what I'm seeing is a move across the country to clean energy. And what's fascinating to me is the diverse cross-section of citizens, landowners, public officials, farmers, electric utilities, environmental activists, and even religious groups from right to left across the spectrum who are in support of that. And so it's happening. I think the recent events in Texas are actually going to accelerate it. And so it's a really fascinating conversation that is going on in a time when the country is really divided. We have this conversation across political boundaries that's really one of the most constructive, collaborative, respectful, and productive dialogues across the boundaries that's maybe going on anywhere.
Right. You know, we were talking about conversations that you need to have with legislators and different energy groups. Do you think those conversations are going to be obviously changing in the light of what happened in Texas?
Yeah, without a doubt. I think Texas is going to inform grid experts all over the country. I think it kind of pushes the agenda as far as infrastructure rebuilding, and particularly related to our electrical grid. I think everybody can see the need for that now. And I do think it's going to, I would be surprised if it does not drastically accelerate the amount of energy storage that we see, because if Texas decides that they don't want to have more transmission coming in and out, then they're going to have to build a lot of storage. And Texas is a big enough state that if they move strongly in that direction, that's going to change markets around the world.
And if you had one takeaway of what happened, what would you say?
Wow.
It's a big question. It's broad.
Yeah, the question is, we have built an infrastructure to fit a planet that no longer exists. Mm-hmm. We've changed the atmosphere of the planet, and we need to upgrade not just our electrical grid, but our entire infrastructure to reflect the conditions that are changed. And if we don't do that, it's going to be a very costly mistake for us to make.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate all of our guests for taking the time today to talk about what happened in Texas and looking here at Indiana and what we can do here. Doug Gotham, director of the State Utility Forecasting Group at Purdue, Peter Sinclair, independent meteorographer who specializes in energy and climate, and Danielle McGrath, president of the Indiana Energy Association. Thanks so much. I'm Taylor Bennett. This is All In.